You're known for having really terrific sources within the Rhode Island court system. How were you able to cultivate those sources when people working in the courts are not supposed to be giving out secrets to reporters?
I started covering the court beat, you know, back in 1974, and I realized right away, I mean, lawyers and judges talk in this foreign language, and I was going to really have to learn how to understand that. So I actually went to some judges and lawyers whose work I respected when I was watching them in the courtroom and asked them just outside of court if I didn't understand something to help. And then my predecessors on that beat were two older men, and, you know, they had curried a lot of favor with members of the bar, but most of the stories they wrote were not particularly critical. Then I came on, and a lot of the old-time lawyers didn't like me because I started ruffling feathers, but I think people in the court system realized that I was trying to sort of uncover the real story there, whether it was good or bad, and that the chips would fall where they may, and I think I built respect over the years. I mean, I spent, of all of the years I spent at the Providence Journal, I probably lived half of my life in that courthouse over on Benefit Street. So I was there every day, and I think I became known as somebody that was also a voice for the powerless and the voiceless. So as much as I love talking to lawyers and judges, it was just as satisfying, or maybe more satisfying, talking to the victims of crime and people who felt like they hadn't gotten a fair shake. I mean, that's the courthouse is the place where the drama of everyday life plays out every single day, and so to me, that was the best beat of all.
Tracy, you've covered a lot of big cases over the years for the Providence Journal. One of the biggest was the murder case against Newport socialite Klaus von Bülow, who was ultimately acquitted in 1985 on charges of killing his wife, Sunny. Almost 30 years later, what are your main takeaways from that case?
Well, that was the first case that was covered gavel to gavel by CNN. And, I mean, it attracted an international media crowd, and it had all of the elements that would attract public interest. I mean, there was tremendous wealth. There was an unusual alleged method of attempted murder by insulin. Some of the biggest socialites and most well-known people in Newport were coming to testify, either for or against. And some of the best lawyers in the country were involved in prosecuting and defending that case.
You were part of a team that won a 1994 Pulitzer Prize at the Journal for revealing wrongdoing in the Rhode Island court system. How did that story get started? How did you get on the trail of it? And what was the key to getting it?
Well, I wasn't the person that actually got the tip that started that investigation. I think it was Kathy Gregg actually getting something and simultaneously.
Kathy Gregg, still the State House Bureau Chief for the Journal.
Yes, she is. And she didn't actually end up writing stories that were involved in that series, but something that somebody passed along to her. And I think my memory is that simultaneously also John Sullivan, who's a former reporter here, who then went to the New York Times, he also got a tip. And it started really very small with we were looking at some money that was missing from a court fund. And the target of that investigation was the son of somebody who was in Rhode Island government.
Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, two chief justices of the Rhode Island Supreme Court resigned while under heavy scrutiny. How has the court system changed for the better or worse since then in Rhode Island?
I do have to say, in retrospect, that the Bevilacqua thing obviously was very distasteful and disturbing to the citizens of the state. But, you know, he was an incredible court administrator. He had background as a leader in our state house. He was always incredibly welcoming to me and made my job a whole lot easier. He got in trouble for associating with people outside of the court. There was never sort of any taint on the decisions that he wrote about, but obviously that was behavior that could not be tolerated. When it came to Tom Fay, he also was a wonderful help to me in covering the system, made it easier for me to do things, and it was very surprising when all these things started uncovering. Do I think that we have a better judicial selection system now? I would have to say I think it's still just as political as it was before. I don't see that there's really any less political influence that goes into selecting the judges. So while there's this merit selection thing and the public is allowed to come in and, you know, ask questions and see this in this very sort of transparent way, I don't think that the system has changed at all.
You've left the Providence Journal as part of the latest in a series of buyouts there. We've seen the reporting staff reduced over time through a series of these buyouts and layoffs. How will the Journal be able to do investigative reporting and thorough reporting on areas like the courts going forward after these reductions in the staff size?
I don't know, to be honest. One of the reasons I left is because I felt like, you know, with all of these buyouts and layoffs, that the staff was getting really thin. And just from my perspective, I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to continue to do the kind of stories that I still want to write for the rest of my life. That said, there are some wonderful people and good reporters and editors that are still left there. The question is what kind of resources we're going to have to be able to do much beyond covering the tip of the news.
You plan to continue teaching at Brown University, where you've been teaching journalism for some time now. Looking at the changes in journalism, how do you feel about the profession going into the future?
It's a noble profession, and, you know, I wouldn't have chosen anything else to spend the last 40 years doing, and I continue to write, and the students that I have at Brown are committed to wanting to do journalistic writing and reporting, whether it be in print or electronic or, you know, radio media or television reporting. I'm concerned that there aren't going to be enough good jobs out there for them, and I'm also concerned that so many of these journalism programs are canceling courses in things like investigative reporting and political public affairs reporting and replacing them with skills-based things on how to make good websites and do a lot of stuff on the web, which I think you could learn in a night class. Luckily, where I'm teaching at Brown, the emphasis has all been on the writing and the reporting. I teach out of the English department in the nonfiction writing program, and the emphasis is on good writing and good reporting, and I'm happy to say that a lot of my students are doing that at wonderful places, ranging from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times to the Washington Post in a terribly difficult time. But also, I don't plan to stop writing. I mean, one of the reasons that I left the Journal was because I'm working on a book proposal on something, and I'll continue doing some freelance writing as well. I don't think I could ever stop writing.
Can you share with us the subject of your book proposal?
I'm going to be expanding a story that I wrote for the Journal in February about Joe Kinnon, the most badly burned station fire survivor who got a hand transplant, and the young man who died and gave him his hand, and some of the other people that got his organs.
Tracy Breton, thank you for sitting down with us, and best wishes.
Thanks so much, Ian. It's always a pleasure.